All right. Appreciate the fact that you all waited on me. I was presenting. I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Committee of Energy to order at 10:33, according to my clock here. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, and we are joined by Representative Carrick, joined by Representative McKay, Representative Wright, Representative Prox, and in the room I don't see any of the legislators at this time. So I would like to thank our House Records Secretary, Jordan Wright, and our LIO moderator, Sydney Truitt. I appreciate all you do, and Craig Valdez, of course, my committee aide. Before we begin, I'd like to ask everybody to silence your cell phones and any other electronic equipment you may have. Since we are going to be witnessing a slideshow, if you hold all your questions till the end of each slide, and all questions should be directed through the chair to the presenter, and then from the presenter through the chair to the members of the committee. Today we're going to hear an overview of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power by Gwen Holdman, Associate Vice Chancellor for Research, Innovation, and Industry Partnerships at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So, if you would, Gwen, if you would like to begin, or should I, is it right? Is Gwen okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you would put your name on record here, you can begin your slideshow.
Thank you to the chair and to the committee for inviting me to speak today. So my name is Gwen Holdman. I am the Associate Vice Chancellor for Research, Innovation, Industry Partnerships for the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the founding director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, also at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I wanted to give you guys a little bit of an overview of what we're doing at the university, but sort of in the context of some of the really interesting things that are happening around energy in the state today. And so I am hoping that we'll have a chance to have a little bit of a dialogue about some of the interesting projects. But first, I did want to just give you a quick overview of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I joined the university in 2008 to form this program. I have a private sector background. I come from the private sector as an engineer, as a developer, and I was interested in joining the university to see how we could build a program that would really work for Alaskans, for our communities, for our businesses in the state in terms of addressing the unique energy challenges that we have here. And so it really started as an idea around 2008. There was some investment by the university. We work closely with the Alaska Energy Authority and the state through that. But it was really sort of brought up as like a bit of a grassroots program. I'm really proud to say that it's actually the first program that's become named as a new institute at the university 2 years ago. And so today there's actually 80 researchers affiliated with this program, both in Fairbanks and Anchorage. We have a couple here in Juneau as well. And it's a really robust research program, primarily funded through non-state resources, but really focused on a state mission around addressing energy issues, very applied focused. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. One of the things I want to point out is that we are both a program that does analysis, but we also have a lot of physical assets. We have a very large lab at the university that emulates a full-scale microgrid at full operating conditions. This would be roughly equivalent to a community of about 500 residents or so, and we're able to test technologies, we're able to test strategies for reducing reliance on things like imported diesel. And that includes both for our remote rural communities, but also things like, for example, the mining industry. We've been really big supporters of looking at energy solutions for the mining industry. In this particular case, we tested a flywheel that was integrated for grid stability into a remote mine in northern Quebec. So we work quite a bit internationally. We're not just working in Alaska, but we do work across the Arctic, and we have partners all over the U.S. and globally as well. These are examples of some of the projects and the locations of our projects over the past decade. Again, what we do is we're really looking for what the challenges are, what the opportunities are that are facing Alaska, and we pull together teams of researchers that can address those particular technologies, those particular challenges that we have across a pretty wide range of different energy challenges. And so those include both fossil, nuclear, renewables has been a pretty heavy focus of our program. But we also look at things like transmission and distribution. We do a lot of analysis, economics. We work closely with the Institute for Social and Economic Research on a lot of the economic analysis too. So generally our philosophy as a research unit is that we emphasize what the question is, what's the problem that we're trying to solve, and we build together a team of resources within the university system. We pull in researchers and resources from outside the university system, and we try to do things on the timeline that the private sector needs or that communities need rather than, you know, the timeline of completing a PhD thesis or something like that. And so that's sort of our general philosophy. I'm going to talk about projects. These are just ones that I'm going to highlight today. It's more really around providing a little bit of a diverse background of some of the things that we're working on in the context of what's important to Alaska today. But I just thought I'd mention where these communities are that I'll just kind of highlight some of them briefly, some of them in a little bit more depth. Before I started, I wanted to also mention that we do a lot of policy analysis. We do a lot of support in developing policies and analyzing policies and programs that exist. And this is one example from the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and state investment in renewables. And I think that this is an interesting analysis. I was curious, as over time we've reduced our investment in the Renewable Energy Fund, it's been my perception that the number of projects being developed across the state hasn't really decreased. And I wanted to see if that was true. And so we did this analysis looking at the state appropriation per year into the Renewable Energy Fund, starting with the first year where there was $100 million invested in that program to sort of kick it off, to 2021, where there was significantly less. And at the same time, looking at the number of projects that were developed across a range of technologies, focused in this case mostly on PCE communities, just to be clear about what the data looks like. And as you can see, even as the investment from the states dropped off, the number of projects that are being developed or the installed capacity for those projects hasn't really decreased. And this, to me, is an example of a really successful program because basically you started it out with an investment from the state, and even as that state investment has declined, the belief and the value that's been created by these projects is such that communities and utilities are finding other ways to fund these projects over time. So I just wanted to throw that out as an example of the kind of analysis that we try to do at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power looking at policy. Last year I was here working on this microreactor nuclear bill, SB-177, because that's a technology that we've been tracking for the last 12 years at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and made some recommendations to changes in state statute that were ultimately essentially approved through the passing of that bill. So those are the kinds of things that we can do to support policy development. And those Renewable Energy Fund projects have resulted in quite a bit of diverse development across the state. I don't want to spend too much time on this slide because you've probably seen this before, and I believe that you heard from the director of the Alaska Energy Authority earlier this week, who probably talked a little bit about some of this investment. So what I want to focus a little bit more on is the fact that Alaska is the U.S. leader in these sorts of microgrid technologies. So we have more installed capacity on microgrids than anywhere else in the country. And I think that that's something that we should be aware of because it actually puts us at an advantage in terms of having capacity, expertise, and knowledge. It's actually relevant to a lot of other places, both in the rest of the country and outside of the nation. And so I just wanted to show you guys that particular graph. This is another one that we've created at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, looking at the Pan-Arctic. You know, we work quite a bit across the Arctic region, and that light blue line there that you see sort of circling the Arctic region shows the edge of the continental grid all around the Arctic, sort of encircling the Arctic. And so everything above that light blue line is basically not grid connected to the rest of the continent, right? And so we know that that's true for all of Alaska, large parts of Canada and Russia as well. And you can see that that line dips quite a bit further south, especially in Canada, of what we conventionally think of as the Arctic. And so we consider this area to be called the Electric North. And so the challenge is that a tiny community called Kineseo in northern Saskatchewan has is more similar to Shungnak in the Alaskan Arctic than it is to the rest of the Saskatchewan province itself. You know, so this is kind of where we're looking at. Where are these challenges around remoteness, around not being able to share power broadly from a geographic standpoint? I'm going to play this little video here, I think. Oh, no, maybe I can't. If I can't, then that's okay. See if it does anything.
Yeah.
It's okay. That's all right. We'll just skip it. I'm just going to skip it all together. So looking at that that Electric North, you know, the other point is that even when we look at the rail belt grid, what we're really looking at is a series of interconnected and nested microgrids with service territories that can operate independently and autonomously from one another should there be a necessity to do so. And that's largely because these did actually grow up as autonomous service areas that were ultimately interconnected at some point in time. And so that's just one of the things I like to think about is Alaska is really just all microgrids at some level all the time. So one of the things that we've been doing on the rail belt is we've been working with the rail belt utilities to really do a robust analysis of different sorts of decarbonization pathways. So there's a tremendous amount of interest, as you're well aware, there was an RPS bill that came out again. So there's real interest in thinking about how we can decarbonize our rail belt grid. And we have tended to take more of this approach as a decarbonization strategy rather than just renewables. And so so that's one of the things that we've been doing. And so in doing this, we've received funding through the Office of Naval Research. We're actually doing this as an independent study with all of the rail belt utilities as partners, but not as funders of the effort, because we all agree that we want it to be an independent effort. And so so we've been working with the Rail Belt Utilities and AEA. We've been funded through the Office of Naval Research in partnership with the University of Hawaii and a subsidiary called Telos that's training us how to use Plexos software, which is sort of the industry standard for this sort of modeling. And this is sort of that longer term, you know, economic modeling of the rail belt around a number of different scenarios. And so that's something that we're doing right now. Our goal is to really build a robust model that then we can input any kind of scenario that might want to be considered in the future. And so this is one example of the work that's currently ongoing. Also related to the rail belt, we've been working on tidal and hydrokinetic energy for a very long time. This is actually one of the earliest programs that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power developed, because 10 or 12 years ago when we first started up, there was a real push to getting the devices, especially in rivers in Alaska. There was a pilot project in both Eagle and in the community of Ruby that essentially failed at that time. And so the question sort of became, how could we potentially make this a viable technology for Alaska? And so we established a test bed in Nenana on the Tanana River. And we've tested a number of devices there over the past decade, working with technology vendors, both privately funded and then through like the Advanced Research Project Agency for Energy, ARPA-E, things like that, where we've been co-designing and co-developing different technologies that work for either in-river or tidal basins.
Ms. Holdman, I'm wondering, in the picture, do you know a lot about the equipment in this picture? In these pictures?
Yes.
Why the black fin?
That.
The black fin in the one turbine.
So you know that's right.
So thank you, Representative Rauscher. That's a great question, and that's actually just to be able to count the revolutions of the.
I figured it was that simple, but I wasn't sure.
Yes, and this is a technology. It's from a company called Oceana. They are based out of Maryland, and we tested this device both in the river, and then we tested the integration of the device onto a grid in our lab afterwards. And actually, that image that we see here is from the lab testing of the integration of that device into a small electric grid. The equipment that you see below in the lower left-hand corner is our test platform. That includes ways to shed debris from the surface and subsurface, because that was one of the major anchoring and surface debris were some of the biggest challenges, as well as like potential impact of fisheries. So we work really closely with Fish and Game on this program. And it's not really the mature fish that is really the biggest concern. It's the out-migrating smolts that kind of wind up getting flushed out in the fastest moving part of the river, and potential impacts to them that are the bigger concern in this case.
Representative Carrick, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I'm just curious if the technology that we're studying for tidal mm-hmm. energy generation is essentially the same technology that we could use in river energy generation. So I'm seeing the Tanana River test site, and is that essentially the same kind of setup that could be used in the Cook Inlet on a scaled basis?
Yeah, Representative Kirk, be the chair. That's a great question. From my perspective, I kind of view tidal or current energy, they are basically the same, right? You either have a river current that's just going in one direction, or in a tidal basin, it's bidirectional flow. Oops. Uh-oh, that's not so good. All right, getting too excited here. Technically, the way that you're extracting energy from the water is the same, but this is sort of like where wind energy was maybe several decades ago, where if you look at early wind generators, some of them have different number of blades and there's different configurations. And now we've sort of settled on like a sort of a three-bladed design that's sort of become the industry standard. And tidal and hydrokinetic energy, that moving water, energy for moving water, they haven't converged on an optimal design yet. So you'll see a lot of different ones that have different sort of configurations and different approaches. Some of them might look like an egg beater going this way. Some don't even use like a rotating piece of equipment. They might work off of shedding vortices. We have a couple technologies we're working with that I'm excited about, because you don't have this big propeller in the water where you've got like a column that might be shedding vortices and just going up and down in the water column that might be more resistant to debris or icing or issues like that. And that's why we're working on optimizing these designs. That's one of the things we're doing. Obviously, Cook Inlet is a completely different sort of environment in a lot of ways. And so really right now, although Cook Inlet is probably one of the very best tidal regimes anywhere in the world, the challenge of actually capturing that energy is difficult. It's sort of like that, you know, there's limitless gold in the ocean, but actually, you know, being able to collect it and use it usefully is difficult. And Cook Inlet, it's pretty condensed there. We have good tidal energy, but as you know, as you're well aware, there's a lot of challenges with operating in that environment. So, yeah.
You okay? Mm-hmm. Representative Prox, you have a question.
Chair, the picture in the lower left, that is your test device in operation. So it looks different than the middle picture, meaning that it isn't fully immersed in the river.
Representative Prox, through the chair, what we have there, and we would welcome you to come and visit the thing, that what you see there is the V shape on the left is the debris diversion device, which is more complicated than it looks, but you know that needs to be a fairly simple thing. So that sheds debris around it. The middle portion of the platform is where you mount the device. So like this particular Oceana device, which was just an example, like there's many others like that, would be installed on that central platform. In the back there, what we've got is a way to actually capture fish. So if there are small smolts that are going through the device, we want to capture those and see if there's any damage to them, you know, what the impacts for fish are. So sometimes we actually put fish through the device, smolt, with permission from Fish and Game, to see what the impact on them is. And it's not necessarily even just impact of the blades on the fish. It's actually pressure differentials, right, across there that can actually impact them as well. So we're really looking to see if there's any negative impact, because we don't want that on fisheries, obviously, and that's a major concern. So, yeah.
Follow up, Representative. Yeah, that is not necessarily intended to work long-term the Tanana River.
No.
Okay, very good.
No, Representative Prox, to the chair, we have this has been operating for 6 years, so this isn't like a new thing. It works very well. We pull it out in the winter. We redeploy it. We use like a big ship's anchor to kind of redeploy it in the spring. But this isn't intended for long-term operation here. It's intended to test different technologies for potential deployment. For example, the project in Igiagic, we have supported that in certain ways as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. I just thought it was
yeah.
worth pointing that out, that this is, it's kind of a glorified wind tunnel.
And I would offer, yes, yes, you could say that, actually, except for it's in a real world and in situ, because we want to look at issues with, you know, sedimentation, smelt. We look at ice impacts, like with things like, for example, frazzle ice can be a real issue, you know, in intermediate seasons. So we're really wanting to do this in situ work, and this has been a really good partnership with several other universities, with the Department of Energy and the National Renewable Energy Lab. They don't work with us on the in-river stuff, but they work with us very closely on the tidal energy stuff. The Pacific Marine Energy Center is sort of broadly this university partnership with the University of Washington, Oregon State, and I know they would love to come and present with you. I'm not the expert on the tidal energy mm-hmm. area, but I want to point this out as a major program that we work on. Okay.
Thank you very much. Ms. Holman, you would like to continue, please.
All right. We'll dive down into another area where the University of Alaska Fairbanks has really been leading research with a number of different universities across the country. In this case, we're working with the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez, South Dakota University, and the University of Hawaii, again, are our primary partners. This is a Department of Energy-funded program. I mentioned about how we're doing this this carbon path decarbonization pathway study for the rail belt. At the other extent of that, so that's sort of that high level, like almost economic dispatch kind of thinking about the different options that you might have. You also have the potential for real implications to stability of a grid when you start to introduce more variable renewable resources compared to sort of the conventional generation that we're used to, which is, you know, consists mostly of big rotating equipment, whether that's, you know, a hydroelectric plant or a coal plant, or, you know, you've got a lot of inertia in the system in that. And it's a way that we actually store energy over very short time periods, because you've got these almost like flywheels in the system that you can kind of hear it if you're running a generator, and it kind of just grinds down a little bit, you know, when you're loading it heavily, but it can kind of ride through that then. We're used to having systems with inertia. Things that are like based on these inverter-based technologies don't have that kind of inertia. They can respond very, very quickly. So they have some really good attributes, but what they don't have is a bunch of inertia. And so the grid can act really differently as we start to have higher and higher contribution levels of renewables. That isn't necessarily bad. It's just different than what we're used to. And so we are doing a lot of modeling around what does it mean when you've got this control. And so the way this looks is like conventional machinery. It's sort of like it operates off of pretty understood laws of like physics and thermodynamics, where it represents these big balls. So it's like a knot of inertia. They're heavy, but they're only going up and down in the system. Whereas a lot of these, what we call converter dominated systems, which are like wind and solar, they're way more flexible. Like they don't necessarily just go up and down. They can go this way or that way and like change how we're like sort of managing the grid on very fine temporal scales compared to conventional generation. We're not really tapping that capability right now, but there's also the potential that we could have failures associated with a reduced amount of inertia on the grid. So these are the things that we need to be thinking about, and smaller grids are sometimes more vulnerable to these sorts of changes because you can't just pull in power from like far away, you know, when there's like some kind of a quick drop off in wind generation or something. So we're interested in this problem, and it's something that we're actually leading nationally in terms of doing this kind of assessment. Again, because Alaska is a place where you're seeing these kinds of challenges or these kinds of this need to figure out how we're going to solve some of these problems, you know? And this is really about modeling the integration of high contribution renewables on a future grid. So I'll give an example related to that from Eielson Air Force Base. So we are working through the Army Corps of Engineers, through the Cold Regions Engineering Lab, and with Eaton on a project to do some much more detailed, enhanced sort of metering of the Eielson grid. And so one of the challenges that they run into sometimes is that they have unexpected islanding events. Sometimes they disconnect from the Golden Valley grid. They have a power plant there, right? But they typically are interconnected with Golden Valley. And sometimes they have events where they trip offline unexpectedly, and it creates fluctuations in the power quality on the grid that can impact their operations. And so there's an attempt to try to better understand the implications of this and how you sort of manage them. What you see here is one of those events. The top left there, this, the blue and pink or green and pink squiggly lines are just the general load, and then the power plant and the Golden Valley grid, and then all of a sudden Golden Valley, that pink just drops offline. And then you see below that where they have stable power quality, very stable frequency, for example, and then once they're disconnected from Golden Valley, they have more frequency variation, and that can be a challenge for them, especially as they're bringing more and more like very advanced military equipment there. And so there's really this desire to really modernize the controls and integrate these more complex systems into the ILSN grid, and that includes the potential for this SMR. And so we're really doing this analysis around this sort of grid stability question, islanding, how do you optimize a system that needs really reliable power, like a military base.
Please continue.
Yeah. So that then brings me to microreactors. So ILSN Air Force Base has been selected as a site for an early demonstration for micronuclear reactors. And this is something that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, we've been tracking this, starting with the request of the legislature back in 2009. This is one of the first things the legislature ever asked us to take a look at. We didn't at that time have any expertise really in this area, but we made it our business over the last 12 or 13 years to continue to monitor this technology and see whether it had the potential for a variety of applications in Alaska. And this is becoming closer and closer to a commercially viable project in general or technology. The first one is right now scheduled to be deployed at Idaho National Lab for testing in 2024. It's an Army reactor that was developed under Project Pele. This ILSN reactor, if it meets the timelines that have been laid out for it, the idea would be that it would be finished in 2027, and this would be the first commercial micronuclear project anywhere in the United States. So this is something we're kind of continuing to track. And one of the biggest things that we feel like our role is, because we're certainly not nuclear engineers, so we're not involved in designing these systems. And we're also really careful not to be technology agnostic. We're not preferentially looking at one technology over another. We want to look at the industry as a whole and what are the right options for the state of Alaska. We're doing a lot of work right now and just trying to educate Alaskans that these are quite different from conventional nuclear reactors. And that's one thing that I hope, if any of you ever have a need to have a presentation for your constituents on this topic, that's something we're really just trying to get that message out, is we're not talking about conventional or legacy reactors. These are really quite different when it comes from a safety standpoint, because they have these intrinsic passive safety features associated with them that are quite different than what we typically think of as nuclear energy.
Representative Carrick, you have a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is a really basic question, but for a small rural community that is using a micronuclear reactor, what's the approximate just size of one of these? And then I know nuclear is not considered a renewable resource, but can you just talk a little bit about the longevity of a micronuclear reactor? And my understanding is they can be used for a long, long, long time. So could you just talk a little bit about the, I guess, sustainability of a micronuclear reactor too?
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Yeah, through the chair. First of all, from a physical size standpoint, these reactors, and I actually wanted to put one with a person in there, but that blue Connex container is a 20-foot Connex. A little bit of an oversized 20-foot Connex, but that's sort of spatially what we're talking about. So the reactor vessel would fit on this table or in the middle of this table, right? So we're not talking about really big systems. That's one thing. You can really think of them, or I like to think of them as a little bit more like a thermal battery. It's a heat source. And so what you do with the heat is kind of up to you. It's a thermal battery. You're not going to break, for the most part, you aren't going to refuel these in a field. There's exceptions to that. They're all a little bit different. There's about a dozen vendors that are looking at different configurations. But they're pretty small. The one in the blue Connex there is Westinghouse eVinci reactor. The idea there is that they would be replaced on an 8-year cycle. So that reactor would be there providing heat. Then you have some sort of a power conversion system associated with that, right? They themselves are not providing electric power. They've produced thermal energy that you need to convert into electric power. through some sort of a secondary process, which we just like we do today with many of our thermal plants, right? The one in the bottom right-hand corner is actually the one that has been proposed for Copper Valley Electric Association has been partnering with on a study over time. And so that's UltraSafe Nuclear Corporation. You can see that their design is proposed to be subsurface, right? So then that you can ask all kinds of questions about that for Alaska, especially in places where we might have permafrost. But, you know, these are the kinds of things that we can be working with the companies, the vendors, the Idaho National Lab, to really look at, like, does this make sense for Alaska? And if it does, under what sort of circumstances would it make sense? I do kind of view this as a fairly, you know, contained solution. Whether this would work for a remote rural community anytime in the near future, I'm not proposing that we send these into a really remote area. A place like Nome or Bethel, again, I'm not necessarily proposing that. One of the things that the bill last year did that we passed is it gave siting authority over any of these projects to the local community. No one can tell Nome or Fairbanks that you're going to have a microreactor. It's a local decision, but this is an opportunity. So a place like Nome could potentially benefit from something like this because its load is actually fairly well matched to what the output from one of these reactors would be. And these reactors, the minimum output for the ones that are being developed is about a megawatt. So that's bigger than, and that's bigger than a really tiny community, right? So you'd need to have at least 1,000 residents in a community before one of these would even make sense from its output. But more likely it would be some of these larger communities. I'm also really interested in understanding whether this could be a distributed solution around the rail belt grid too, right? Could you look at like downtown Fairbanks, you know, could this be an alternative for heating downtown Fairbanks if or when the Aurora plant shuts down? And what we have to think about is that there will be a day when that plant probably goes out of service, right? Right now, I think the contract with Golden Valley ends in 2030. These are not, this is about the timeline when these technologies will become available. So those kinds of questions are things that we're interested in helping communities and sites to model to see if this would be a possible option.
Representative Wright has a question. Were you okay? Representative Wright has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, has there been any testing with these microreactors? Any success stories? Military?
Yeah, Representative Wright, through the chair. So first of all, this technology typically isn't really new, right? I mean, this is stuff that's been developed over a very long period of time. Obviously, the United States has a long history of familiarity with nuclear technologies. I guess one of the things I want to mention is that it's not just about the small size, right? We've been building nuclear reactors that are small for submarines for a really long time. You could call that a micro reactor, but they don't have these intrinsic safety characteristics associated with them. So they're not an advanced nuclear reactor. An advanced reactor could be a big reactor that has these intrinsic or inherent safety characteristics associated with it. There have been no advanced microreactors built in the United States or anywhere in the world to date, but components of it have been tested. The fuel's been developed. I was recently at Westinghouse, and they have designed all of the heat pipes that passively remove the heat from the reactor core. We know how to configure reactor cores. So the components have been developed. The one that's under construction right now is this Project Pele reactor for the Army. It's BWXT is the vendor that's building that reactor using this TRISO fuel that's been sort of identified as one of the optimal fuels for these. That should be deployed next year if it stays on schedule. It's not a commercial reactor. It hasn't been regulated through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for commercial use, but this could be a step on the way there. Right now, the Army is not seeking that. They're looking at that reactor is truly transportable, truck-mounted, for forward-operating emergency locations. So, yeah. And we're working closely with that group, actually, with the Strategic Capabilities Office from the Army to look at how we could model some of the steps that they've taken, how that could apply to maybe a more proactive approach here in Alaska to thinking through how microreactors could be part of our future energy mix.
Thank you.
Thank you. My question is, you're saying that we have no prototype at all in the United States. We're actually building it right now.
Well, that's correct. That's correct, Representative. Those will be tested at national labs and at defense sites first.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Please continue. Oh, Representative Prox has a question. Through the chair, he has a question.
The what?
Through the chair, he has a question.
Through the chair, he has a comment. To kind of get a grasp on this, you can build a reactor. If you got enough money, you can build a reactor, put it on a little satellite, and shoot it out to study Pluto. It's just finding something that fits to a particular situation is really the challenge.
Representative Pax, to the chair, responding to your comment, this kind of comes back to the fact that engineers can engineer just about anything.
Exactly.
The economics matter,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, throw enough money at it, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly.
And I don't mean that entirely facetiously, but that's what we've got to think about.
Yeah.
Please continue.
So we are working with NOAAM right now to model a micro reactor as a potential option for them. We're working closely with MIT on that. They have a lot of expertise, as well as the Center for Advanced Energy Studies at Idaho State University. We work closely, again, with these other university partners, pull in their expertise to look at supporting Alaskan communities and making decisions. So we're working on modeling micro reactors as an option for them today. I wanted to highlight NOAAM because we've actually worked with NOAAM for a long time across a whole range of different technology solutions. One of the projects that they have going on there right now is that there's likely to be a small geothermal power plant that will be deployed at Pilgrim Hot Springs outside of NOAAM in the near future. And that's a little bit of a culmination of work that we've been supporting them with over the past, 13 years or something like that. Starting with doing a really comprehensive evaluation of this Pilgrim Hot Springs geothermal resource, looking at what the potential was for developing it, what its maximum output could be, drilling a confirmation well, which we also designed as a potential well for that could be used for production later, convinced the funding agencies that it was cheaper to drill a production hole than just a test hole. And that was true. and then really setting that up for able to do something on site. Separately from that, we've worked a lot on can we utilize waste heat from diesel engines for additional power generation. And so we've been looking at these organic Rankine cycle technologies to see how can we more efficiently use rejected waste heat from industrial processes and diesel generators. And part of this comes from my background. I was actually the lead engineer for designing and developing the Chena Hot Springs geothermal power plant. So I became very familiar with these technologies when the Alaska Center for Energy and Power was first stood up. There wasn't a lot of people there. I didn't have a big team, so we leveraged a lot of my knowledge on the engineering side with the technology and then the drilling side with geothermal. And so I'm really excited because these are sort of coming together. That technology that we've been working toward developing for waste heat recovery for diesel generators can also be used with geothermal fluid, right? And so right now there's a good chance that one of these small, you can see containerized organic Rankine cycle that in that green box there, we tested that in our lab at the university for applications around recovered waste heat, not for geothermal. But that same company is likely to be a supplier for this small geothermal power plant out at Pilgrim Hot Springs, which would also be sort of a prototype, first small power plant out there. And so, I mean, we're talking tiny, like tens of kilowatts, not bigger than that, just for on-site generation. It's not grid tied to NOAAM right now. The potential out there eventually, it could generate, we believe, up to 5 megawatts of geothermal power. There's also a mine that's been proposed there, Graphite One Mine. So there's a possibility of like seeing a small grid developed in NOAAM that could include nuclear, it could include geothermal, could include wind that they already have. Those are the kinds of things that we can help think through how that could work for all of these different users and resource owners. So,
I was wondering, there's a lot of space between rows of solar panels. Is there a formula for how much space you need to keep? I guess it's the foliage growing between them. Is there a formula for that, or is it just whatever? Each project is different.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher, Chair. I NOAAM has some solar, but I think you're thinking of Kotzebue is the one that has the larger solar project out there. They have a half a megawatt of solar installed. I actually have a picture of that. And you're right, they are fairly well spaced apart. Part of the reason is because they're bifacial arrays. So the cool thing that they're doing that we're taking, this is another bit of research. I'm actually not talking about this here, but we've really been working for a long time to understand how we can best do solar in a subarctic environment. And one of the things that we've been doing is doing solar on both sides of the panel, right? So instead of just having one face that's collecting energy, doing it on both sides, which means that you're collecting a lot more light throughout the day. And that's why those panels are spaced so far apart, so that the backside can get light as well as the front side.
And the reason I asked was because they're going to put an array in the Willow area now, I think it is, or Houston. So I was just wondering whether the spacing was going to be as large or whether it was going to be smaller, or if you had any idea how they feel it. Because the amount of panels that we're going to have there is enormous. And I'm just wondering, are they going to be a little tighter? Or how's that? Do you have any idea how that's going to be set up?
Question there is, are they bifacial panels?
Okay.
And I don't know the answer.
Decided yet.
I'm going to guess it has been decided. Okay. But I'm not sure about that. Like, the incremental cost for a bifacial panel is not that high. So, like, where it makes sense, you might as well get a bifacial panel. And in the far north, it makes a lot more sense than other places. Because, you know, we used to do a lot of these, like, rotating, like, trackers and stuff.
Yeah.
That's more complicated, you know, that's more complicated. So just a bifacial array that captures more light gets more economic use, especially in a place where the sun kind of goes around in circles a little more. I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any questions? Please continue. Representative
Before
Cox,
we get too far away,
questions.
Yes.
Through the
you
chair.
Had talked about your experience with the plant at Gene Hopkins.
Yes.
And they set one on a trailer, I recall,
yes,
and hooked it up to the power plant downtown Fairbanks. I was kind of surprised that it seems to have fizzled,
yes,
but it looked like a really good idea.
Yes.
Any short history?
Yes. So Representative Prax, to the chair. So here's the problem with those kinds of systems. When you don't have a lot of hot water, steam, or heat, you know, available, you, number one, need your it's not your Chena Hot Springs use a lot of cooling water too. The thermal efficiency is about 6%. It's using, let's say, you know, 150 gallons per minute of hot water and 3,000 gallons per minute of cooling water on the condenser side. Hmm. So you don't just need the heat. You need some way on the cooling side to cool it. What we did at Chena initially is we set up a siphon hydro to siphon water, groundwater, 3,000 gallons a minute through the condenser. There's no parasitic load on the cooling side. Once you have to pump that water or air cool, your thermal efficiency gets lower and lower and lower, where it stops to make sense. You need more heat to start make it make sense. And there's not that much heat actually that they're rejecting. They're doing a pretty good job of squeezing as much heat out of that system as they possibly can. And so what they're rejecting is lower quality heat that makes it a lot harder to capture any additional value.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense.
And the reason that was was designed, by the way, that mobile unit was actually to recover heat directly off of wellheads, mm-hmm, because those temperatures are not that dissimilar to the Chena Hot Springs temperatures that you have. You know, about 165 Fahrenheit, like a good hot cup of coffee, probably like the one I spilled here on the floor earlier, you know. Mm-hmm. And so wellheads are often producing at that temperature. So could you capture that heat and use that to generate power at the wellhead? And that was why that mobile unit was developed.
Okay. So it was a lack of cooling water. I got a little too far into the weeds. I'm sorry, but it was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please continue.
So a lot of these, you know, one of the things that I just wanted to throw out to this committee for consideration that I've been thinking about a lot, as we're seeing these new technologies that are of interest, whether it's nuclear or carbon capture, utilization sequestration, or new advanced battery systems. One of the programs we used to have was the Emerging Energy Technology Grant Fund. This was a complement to the Renewable Energy Fund, but it was less specifically geared toward rural applications. It was really about looking at these emerging technologies that we that could have application in Alaska, and doing a more coordinated way of like testing and trying out these technologies in a way that we're also collecting the data so we understand whether it works and how it works and under what conditions it works. This program sunsetted in 2018, but something like this, I think, is a really important tool in our toolkit for evaluating opportunities around these new technologies. And so I just wanted to throw this out there as something that I would be interested in seeing resurrected as a program that could really help us start to really think through what these emerging technologies could look like in situ in Alaska. So I'm just going to throw that out there. So here's the Kotzebue one. So here's your long, this is exactly the picture you are looking for, is that long distance in between those arrays. So like when you look at it from here now, if you think about the sun being in the north in Kotzebue, it's above the Arctic Circle. That's a big part of why capturing that 24 hours of light is a big part of why they're so far apart. In this case, they also were not space constrained. And so that's another bit of it. But in Kotzebue, what they're trying to do there is they're trying to move to 100% renewables. You know, they're at 70% penetration of renewables from wind and solar right now, and they'd like to continue to kind of push that envelope. That's going to require, in order to do that, a lot more sort of dispatching of extra wind and extra resources when they have it. So right now they've got an electric boiler in a hospital. So basically what they do is when they have excess wind, they just dispatch that for heating, right? And this is a strategy that's commonly used in rural Alaska for many communities. So you overproduce with wind, and then you just shave off that top, send it to heating in individual households or in a centralized boiler like at the hospital, and then you can count on the wind output. Because it's fluctuating up here. Your base is here, your demand, right? And so as long as like there's not some totally crazy thing that happens, like it absolutely stops blowing instantly, you're in pretty good shape to be able to count on that. You can turn off your diesel generators, run off of 100% wind, and heat a lot of homes or space heat with it too. That's being done right now. This is why I'm saying Alaska is actually the leader in many of these areas. A lot of what we talk about most of the country is adding load. So like, oh, we have excess solar, right? We're going to add load. Let's plug in your electric vehicles when we have excess solar, right? We have cheap power. We want to get people to use it. In Alaska, we're doing the opposite strategy. We're saying we're going to overproduce, and then we're going to add load. We're going to add load preferentially at the power plant level. And so it's actually really cool what we're doing in rural Alaska in these remote places. It's applicable to other markets. I'd actually like to see the rail belt utilities like look at some of this a little bit more. But in Kotzebue, we are working on getting them much better granular data about load so that we can set them up to get to 100% renewables whenever the wind and sun is shining. So that's not going to include like long duration storage, but they want to be able to, if the wind is blowing, they want to be able to shut off the diesels entirely. And right now they still need the diesels to provide that sort of that control, that frequency, that grid support. And so we're working with them on strategies how to get away from that. So this is actually kind of a cool blog. I put the link in here, but I just thought this was neat because we had nothing to do with writing this article. It was from this company called Kartorium, which is a Launch Alaska company. And they wrote this up and they said, you know, why do we need an energy innovation ecosystem in Alaska? And they wrote this blog about this cool thing that they saw happening in Kotzebue really organically, not super planned. Like there was some grant that everybody showed up, but it's basically like two startup companies, two innovation groups, a research group, and an energy utility that got together to kind of solve this problem, right? So we're working with these two startup companies under Launch Alaska, Kartorium and 60 Hertz. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power is there, like doing a lot of the mapping and looking at the grid there. And then you've got this Alaska Center ICE, the Center for Innovation, Commercialization, and Entrepreneurship. My new role at the university is about starting up and really getting the university to be like the innovation hub, the Skunk Works, the place that we come to innovate in the state. And Alaska Center ICE is under that. And then at the University of Alaska Anchorage, the Business Enterprise Institute is our close partner on that. Students to Startups is the way a lot of the kids got out here to work on this. And so it was this really neat confluence of different partners that got together organically to solve a problem. And it's really described in this blog. And I think it's kind of a cool story. So I'll just throw that out there. But that's often the way that we work, is just bringing in a lot of different things. I'm just going to throw out a couple more things. Air source heat pumps is a growing technology of interest in Alaska. I mean, that's one thing we need to be thinking about is, like, are we going to be adding more electrification, whether it's electric vehicles or air source heat pumps, as we're seeing dynamics and price changes, you know, things like that. And so we've been looking at preferential price structures for the electric utility, in this case for Inside Passage Electric Cooperative down here in Southeast. We do work in Southeast too. And then up in Kotzebue, actually looking at, like, do these things actually work in the Arctic, right? I mean, can you extract heat from the air, and does this actually make sense in an Arctic environment? How does that interact with power cost equalization, right? There's a lot of different questions there. Like, maybe it works, but maybe it works because we're gaming the power cost equalization system. Or maybe it works because it works under certain criteria. And if so, we want to make sure people aren't using them during a time where it no longer becomes economic for them. So we're working pretty closely with a lot of different stakeholders out there. The Northwest Arctic Borough has been a real proponent of deploying these systems. And I think what they're doing is really interesting. But we want to help them. You know, we want to support local organizations that are looking for solutions for their residents. Hmm. And through that, we're developing and designing these community innovation hubs. And so this is a big part of, like, how we're sort of organizing ourselves and pulling in partners. So we're not just, like, popping in and out of communities on, like, one project or another, but we're really partnering with the communities around these solutions. And so the two communities that we're really partnering with to demonstrate and test technology. So this is like the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, testing things in a place where the community is a partner to that testing. The two right now are Kotzebue and Cordova. And so Cordova, for example, we've worked with them to be a test bed for fuel testing, for fuel additive testing. You know, there's, like, been sometimes there's talk about, oh, if we do fuel additives, it'll improve diesel efficiency. Let's really look at that in a controlled way. And so we worked with Kotzebue on that. They've also tested organic rank, and I'm sorry, Cordova. You know, they've tested other things there. They've been a real proponent of innovation. And so we're working to support them in these areas where they want to innovate, but where we also see opportunities to bring in new technologies and test them in a way that benefits the community and benefits the innovator, but protects the community or provides benefit and value to everybody. With that, we work really closely with the schools. We view them as, like, sort of the hub. And so we have this teaching through technology program that we partner with. That's my personal favorite. I just love what they're doing with the kids, because they're teaching them skills, tech skills, but they're connecting them with community problems. So they're saying, hey, go out in the community and find somebody that has a problem. You, individual, kid, find somebody that has a problem, or you have a problem, or you see a need. And these kids are coming in and they're designing solutions for problems in their own communities. And it's so neat to see that. And so I love that program. We're setting up more of these teaching through technology site hubs. This is a global program now. There are 23 states that have this teaching through technology program. It was born and designed in Alaska. It was originally called the Modern Blanket Toss, where you kind of use drones to go up and look on the horizon for things in a flat area, like on the North Slope. But today it's, like, really, really grown, but it's national, but it was born and is still based in Alaska. And I think that's really cool. So around that training and workforce development, which is really important to us, we also have this Arctic Remote Energy Network Academy that we manage. It's a partnership with Iceland, Canada, and we bring people together from all around the Arctic region that are in positions to develop projects in their home communities to help them learn from each other and learn from experts, so that lessons from one project is transferable to other regions. You know, like the northeastern Canada, the Colowit, has a lot of potential Nunavut for wind energy development, just like Kotzebue has done, but nobody there thinks it's really viable, right? So we would like to transfer lessons from Alaska to places like that, or Greenland, so that they're learning from and benefiting from, frankly, some of the mistakes that we've made, and making sure they're not repeating those. And so these are local people from across the Arctic that we're bringing together to teach. The bottom right-hand picture was from this summer. That's actually one of the wind towers in Kotzebue, and those are, like, the heat fins for the thermosiphons to keep the ground cold underneath, is those kind of tan-looking uprights that you see there. So that's an example of innovation that's really Alaska-based that would work anywhere in the Arctic. And we're doing these open courses to also do this knowledge sharing, so foundations of microgrids. Right now, we're really hoping to work with our College of Engineering and Mines to develop an energy engineering resource, energy resource engineering program. So really rethinking about how we're teaching energy, not being so stovepiped into like petroleum and mining and then renewables, but really thinking about it as holistic, right? It's a spectrum. And so what we want to do is pull that all together under a single umbrella and have it be energy resource engineering and offer that as both an undergraduate and graduate level. So we're working pretty hard on thinking through what that looks like. And we do these workshops. So this is one, again, just is about trying to share information about technologies that people aren't necessarily familiar with. The next one we have that's coming up is in April. It's on carbon capture and sequestration. It's called The Myth and the Reality. So what we want to do is get accurate information out there to the general public so that they understand what this technology is about. And so we're really designing that. We're bringing in speakers from overseas, including from Canada, the first carbon capture project that's operated anywhere in the world at commercial scale on a coal plant. We're going to bring the folks in from there, from Iceland doing CarbFix, which is direct air capture and sequestration. And so so we're really pulling in experts and expertise to benefit Alaskans. And these are other ones that we've had in the past. These are all free, and they're all kind of lead up to the Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference, which we're also supporting really heavily in May.
So it says register now. There is no limit, right?
There's no limit. There's no limit to registration, and it's totally free to attend any of these. And they're recorded, so people can go back. The reason I put these in here is these examples. Every single one of these workshops, if you're interested in tidal or micronuclear, these are kind of your 101 opportunity to kind of get the broad scale, kind of neutral, impartial perspective on these technologies, not the sales pitch, you know? So these are all available online. This one's on carbon capture sequestration. The next one is long duration energy storage beyond lithium ion batteries. So that's the next one. These are all available on the Sustainable Energy Conference website. And then also the best way to learn about everything we're doing, encourage a lot of your staffers are on our newsletter. So that's another good option. And I should just also highlight that a huge number of our students that have been interns with ASAP, you know, they're here, they're everywhere in the state. You know, our students are really working to continue to work in the energy industry or just to better the state. Ed King was here earlier today. Haley Payne is one of our former interns. She's with DNR. They're working in the utility industry. They're still at the university, you know, and there are a lot of them that are in the private sector. And so I just think that our work with students and our work with educating folks across the state has been really important. And so with that, I just want to say, you know, I think of the University of Alaska. I joined the university not because I had to have a job there, but because I believe the university is a key institution for the success of our state in the future, and that it's a resource for all of us. So I look at it as our skunk works, our think tank, and how we're investing in future human capital. So I'll just end with that plug. So,
well, I appreciate it. It was very good. I appreciate it very much. And I just wanted to ask one question. Like, you know, of the programs that involve renewable energy funding that you've seen in, work in the state of Alaska, I was wondering, are there any one of the funding elements out there that you've seen works the best, or are there a collection of them that you've seen work well that we've put out? And is there some hints that you might give us toward providing new? I think there's a Green Bank bill that might come out that might be of help out there for those projects. But which ones do you see working the best in the state?
Well, one of the really important programs that maybe, I don't know if Director Thayer talked about it on Tuesday, but the Power Project Loan Fund has been a really critical funding mechanism, you know, that I think could be even kind of expanded if you wanted to, because it's good and it's really designed around the specific and unique sort of Alaskan needs and small projects and things mm-hmm. like that. That's been a really important one on the loan side. Right now, there's so much opportunity at the federal level. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to get more organized as a state in meeting the opportunity space there. There's a lot of opportunity to be an aggregator of some of these federal funding programs that are out there. And if we could be more organized around our approach to being an aggregator for some of these resources, Alaskans would really benefit from the resources that are out there. You know, I'd really like to see us do that. Some of these things that are out there right now are probably generational investments in infrastructure, and we need an organized strategy to ensure Alaska benefits as much as we can from what's out there. I'll just say that. And I do think this Emerging Energy Technology Fund is important too. I'm excited about this energy task force that the governor has put together.
Are you on it?
I am.
I figured.
I've been appointed as the vice chair of the committee, and I'm pretty excited about that as an opportunity to think broadly and creatively about the direction that this state can be going in the future. So.
Appreciate it. I saw a Representative Carrick's hand before I saw Representative Brock's. Go ahead, Representative.
I guess I'll go first then. through the chair, I wanted to go back to the slide on the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. Can you talk a little bit about why the program sunsetted in 2018 and what was different about this program, or what could be currently different about this program from, say, the Renewable Energy Grant Fund?
Representative Carrick, through the chair, I'm actually glad that you brought that up. Renewable Energy Grant Fund is designed to fund mature technologies. You know, those projects should not fail. We should have a high expectation that those are successful deployments using commercial technology. The Emerging Energy Technology Grant Fund was really designed to accept risk, right? Like, some of these technologies that are new may not work. So, and what happened is you see some of them, like the seawater heat pump in Seward was funded through this. Now they've been adopted other places in the state. We tested it out, it worked. And then we saw them adopted other places, right? Other ones, there was a really kind of a cool project in Cordova using like methanogens biodigester kind of thing that the school kids did down there. It was a super cool project, but it didn't work. It didn't pencil out. You know, it worked. They learned a lot. In fact, actually, the students got a huge amount of benefit out of what they wound up doing, having been part of that project. But it wasn't something that you would replicate other places. And the thing is, you know, we collected the data, we did a report on that, and it shows this isn't something that's viable for other communities. But there was still benefit, you know, to that individual community in doing that. It was one of our favorite projects. It was like $30,000 or something. It wasn't a huge investment. To me, this program is really a key complement to the Renewable Energy Fund because of that risk element. This is where we want to try risky things, and we want to make investment in things that might fail but could have a huge upside if it works. And we want to really be able to monitor and meter the outcomes and the results so we have accurate information so other people can make good decisions about it. It sunsetted because I think partially it was a little bit before its time, and the legislature chose to let it sunset after 5 years because there wasn't funding to continue it. That was during that time where we really weren't funding the Renewable Energy Fund. So, you know, they were they're complementary programs, you know, so that's where we are with it.
Representative, follow-up?
Follow-up, yeah. I guess it's more of a comment. You know, often in this committee, and in other committees, we have conversations about how the state funds different things and where we best put our money for the future, if we, you know, fund schools fully, if we fund energy projects. So I guess, considering that we have all these emerging technologies and we have all this resource potential in Alaska that's maybe untapped with things like hydrogen or micronuclear, can you just expound a little bit on, sell it to us? What is the potential long-term value of putting funding into emerging technologies on a state level as opposed to just seeking federal grants or seeking research dollars elsewhere?
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative, through the chair. A couple things there. Number one, there's some unique issues in Alaska, you know, and so sometimes you can find the appropriate federal funding for things. A lot of these grants were co-shared, co-financed between a federal grant and a state grant. So state investment can really help. For example, if we want to do micro reactors, I think there's a high probability that we can get a large investment or large partnership with the federal government, but I think there's going to be some requirement for state investment as well. I think that when you're looking at this compared to school funding or something like this, those are pretty difficult choices to make. That's what we count on you to, in part, make those decisions around. But the thing about investment in energy and energy infrastructure is that when we bring the cost of power down, that's something that's a really equitable thing. If we're able to do that for all of our residents by investing in technologies that are going to provide more sustainable long-term funding that are going to help our industries thrive here, right? A lot of our industries have the need for maybe lower carbon targets. I know that that's an issue in Fairbanks with Kinross and things like that. You know, if we can do that as a society here, everyone benefits, right? I also think we all benefit. We have a strong education system, a strong university, right? But education or energy is something that we can really put funding into. It's not something that people are going to get taxed on. If they have a reduced energy bill, they fully benefit from that. And we all benefit from that. And it's something that, as a society, we rely on energy. We can't not do with energy. We need cheap, affordable energy in this state. And that's why I used to live off-grid. I lived off-grid for 20 years, and I did not have electric power. I cut wood, and it was hard. And I never want to do that again. And so I really, really appreciate the value of that's why I got into energy research, right, is because I fully appreciate both the issues with trying to do renewables and the need for reliable, cheap power. That's my background. And if you don't have access to affordable, reliable power, we as a society can do very little. And so Alaska really has an opportunity because we have so many resources and so many options. And maybe in part we have too many, right? We have 10 different directions we could go, and that makes the choices more complicated. So, but I think reliable, cheap energy is a critical need for our future.
Thank you. That was a great sales pitch. I really appreciate it. We ask these questions all the time about our priorities, and so it's good to put that in perspective as we talk about emerging technologies too.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, first an easy one. Could you state your philosophy again a couple of times way back on the third slide or one, two, three, fourth slide?
Oh, the
slide.
Philosophy?
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Prox.
I mean, that emphasis is on the resource question,
Not
the interests of individual researchers. I think that is the key to the success.
Representative Prox, through the chair, there's a couple fundamental things. Number one, the university shouldn't be doing what private sector can do, right? Mm-hmm. So we should not be competing with private sector. And so that's super important. If it's a commercial project with commercial technology, if there's a need for information that we can help with the private, we should just get out of the way, right? However, where there is a need for like a specific, I'll give an example with the tidal energy or the hydrokinetics. Nobody at the university had any expertise in that or in nuclear. I mentioned that. So the deal is, here's the problem. Here's the thing that we need to understand as Alaskans. How do we get the expertise and knowledge to do that? How do we make sure, build up some capacity at the university, if that makes sense? How do we pull in expertise from elsewhere, the best and the brightest people that we can apply to Alaskan challenges? Do we need some tools or resources? You know, do we need the lab, for example? The lab was a big investment, but we felt that we needed it to test these systems because no one could do it in the messy, complex way that rural power happens. You can plug a device into some clean power grid at NREL in the lower 48, or you can put it on someplace where you're going to have these massive wild power fluctuations, and it's not going to operate the same way. We need to put it in situ the way it's going to happen in Alaska and make sure that we're actually getting real data, real operational data from the crazy way that in the messy way that we do power in rural Alaska before we send stuff out to some rural place and then it fails out there because it couldn't handle like a two hertz frequency deviation. You know, we don't want that to happen out there. It should happen in the lab. And then we send it out there once it works, right? Mm-hmm. This battery, I think St. Mary's, I actually forgot that one. We're testing a battery in our lab this summer. Then we're sending it out to St. Mary's. It's a new system. We don't want it to fail there. So we're working Alaska Village Electric Corporation, cooperative. We're going to test it in our lab, then send it out to St. Mary's. Not put it out there and then it fails, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my philosophy, is that what's the problem we're trying to solve in Alaska? How can the university help solve that? And if it's commercial, that means basically getting out of the way. If it's a newer technology, we want to help make sure it's as successful as possible.
Sure, Representative.
Through the chair, do you have some sort of a decision-making rubric? You said there's dozens of things we could do. Do you go through, do you have an organized decision-making process to objectively try and figure out which is the right thing to do?
Representative Prox, to the chair, I'm really glad you're asking these questions because that's actually been a really, really important thing is to not, there's so much you could do. We've really tried to have a strategic plan on the things that we're specifically focusing on. For a long time, I was really opposed to doing solar energy. I'm like, it's a commercial technology. There's nothing that we need to do on a research space there. It should just happen, right? I was eventually convinced that things like these bidirectional arrays and the way that you would orient and design stuff for the Arctic has some unique needs. And so we wound up building up a solar energy research program as a strategic initiative because I became convinced that there were some questions that we could uniquely address that then would help the private sector make good decisions in how to implement projects, you know, for example. But there's a lot that we can't do everything. And I'm really, really careful to make sure that we're maximizing the value that we're creating. We get not that much funding from the state. So part of it is driven by where we can find funding and resources and partners. So there are sometimes things like, for example, nuclear has been a challenge for us, a really big challenge, because our primary, most flexible source of funding is through the Office of Naval Research. And they specifically prohibit us from working on nuclear because the funding bucket that we have from them is not their nuclear part, and so we are explicitly prohibited from working on nuclear. That's why I was down here. That's why I wrote the report, because I couldn't pay anyone to work on nuclear in my organization. It meant that I worked nights and weekends to put together that report for you guys 2 years ago, and that's how I wound up down here, because I couldn't pay anyone to do it because I didn't have any funding. So that was an example of where there was a need, but there was no money. And so we couldn't really do it, but we just did it anyway. Mm-hmm. And that was through a lot of unpaid work, you know. Since then, we've actually received an increment from the state to continue to work on nuclear. So we really appreciate that because that's made it much easier for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Quick follow-up. Through the chair, is that written down somewhere or is that just in your head? Because that process works for other decision-making scenarios. If you've written it down, I'd like to see a copy.
Representative Fox, through the chair, I would love to continue this conversation. I'd love to share with you that strategic rubric that we put together. This is, I believe, is one of the most important things as an organization or a state or whatever, you know, we're looking at. We need to have a rubric about how we're making decisions and what are the most important attributes of those of related to that, and that's whether we're investing time or effort making decisions around our energy future or whatever that looks like. So yeah, I'd be happy to share that. No one's ever asked me that.
All right. Yes. Thank you.
Well, seeing no more questions, I do want to thank you for coming down. It's always very interesting, the everything you provide us. It's always a pleasure to have you here in the committee. I thank you for all the work you did with us on the microreactor bill we had a couple years ago. That was a very interesting, a very knowledgeable trip on that one, and I appreciate the time you took to help us out there. But seeing no more business today, I'm going to adjourn this meeting. The time is 11:46. Need glasses.
Just like me, I have.
Right, it's real smart. It's tiny little times. It's 11:46. This meeting is now of the Energy Committee is now adjourned.